Morning. Born in 1921, Alan Freed dreamed of being a big band leader. I'm pretty sure our children today, when they are born, are not dreaming of being a big band leader, but that was not all that uncommon back in the 1920s and 30s. In high school, Alan and his friends formed a band called the Sultans of Swing, in which he played trombone. I've never heard of the Sultans of Swing. There's probably a reason for that, because shortly after graduating from high school, Alan, like all other young men his age during the 1940s, served in the U.S. Armed Forces. His dreams were put on hold. But while overseas, Alan wasn't on the front lines, but rather Alan was working in a studio as a disc jockey for the Armed Forces Radio. When he returned home from the war, Alan continued to work as a disc jockey on the radio, working in Cleveland, Ohio during the late 1940s and early 1950s. And at the time, the disc jockeys had they had the ability to play essentially whatever music they liked and what they wanted. So Alan would play a mix of rhythm and blues, jazz, country, and pop records that was really unlike anything else that was on the radio. He called this style of music rock and roll. As a result, Alan Freed is often referred to as the father of rock and roll. Not because he himself was a rock and roll musician. I mean, that was his dream in life, but dreams change. And he wasn't called the father of rock and roll because he himself was a musician, but rather because as a disc jockey, he was the first to coin the term and the first to promote the style of music. In the late 1950s, Alan's career was soaring. He was headed places. He had moved to one of the most listened to radio stations in New York City. His radio show was being replayed on hundreds of other radio stations across the United States. He appeared in a number of early rock and roll films. And he even hosted his very own weekly primetime television show. The Big Beat was sort of a precursor to what eventually became the American Bandstand. You know, a television show where these early rock and roll bands would play and it would air during prime time. However, all of this would come crashing down in one moment. On the fourth episode of The Big Beat, Alan showed Freddie Lemons, who was the black lead singer for the group The Teenagers, dancing with a white girl from the studio audience. This kind of mixed race interaction was not yet socially acceptable. And this created quite the stir. Alan's television show was canceled. He even eventually lost his radio job. He became unhirable. And there were other things that happened. Alan's life began to spiral. He began to drink excessively. He was divorced, remarried, divorced again, remarried again. He got caught up in a commercial bribery scheme. But all of that downward spiral started after that one moment on The Big Beat. Alan Freed's reputation was ruined. Our reputation is like a delicate flower, isn't it? It takes a very, very long time to develop, and yet a moment to destroy. It's the culmination of years of work, countless deeds and tasks, and sometimes only one small, seemingly insignificant action or words could destroy it. Just like stepping on a flower that's taken all spring, all summer to grow, destroyed in a moment. And here's the thing, everybody knows that. I didn't need to tell you that your reputation was fragile. Everyone knows it, and it's sort of been known for all time. Benjamin Franklin said, "It takes many good deeds to build a good reputation, and only one bad one to lose it." Will Rogers says, "It takes a lifetime to build a good reputation, but you can lose it in a minute." Warren Buffett says, "It takes 20 years to build a reputation and 5 minutes to ruin it." If you think about that, you'll do things differently. The Bible has a lot to say about our reputation, and maybe it's best summed up in a passage that we read Wednesday night. That's really what got me thinking. Wednesday night, we studied from the latter part of Proverbs, and in Proverbs chapter 22, verse 1, we're told, "A good name is to be chosen rather than great riches, loving favor rather than silver and gold." Our name, our reputation, what people think of when they think of us, is more valuable than great riches. Now, Wednesday night, we were kind of moving through those chapters, and we didn't get a lot of time to spend talking about these individual verses, but I'm going to talk about reputation, and specifically its impact on how we influence others and our influence on others. So we're going to talk about our reputation and how it impacts our influence on others. So let's just first start by talking about our reputation. What is a reputation? Well, reputation is the common opinions and beliefs about someone or something. Now, reputations aren't just limited to people. Benjamin Franklin and Will Rogers, they were talking about personal reputations. Warren Buffett wasn't talking about a personal reputation. Warren Buffett was talking about a business's reputation. So a reputation is the common opinions or beliefs about someone or something. It's what you're known for and what people remember about you. So let's put this definition to a test. I'm going to give you the name of a person or a business or a product, and I just want you to call out the very first thing that comes to mind. All right? Business, person, or a product. Now, I just want you to tell me the first thing that comes to mind. Abraham Lincoln. Okay, I didn't catch that. What?
The slaves.
Slaves, okay. Truth. Freed the slaves.
Truth.
Truth, integrity. All right? Benedict Arnold.
Traitor,
yeah. Maybe that one was a little easier, huh? A Yugo. Small, yeah. I'm dating some people here, right? Small. If you're under like 40, you might not even know what a Yugo is. Okay. Chick-fil-A. Oh, I'm not hearing anything. Oh, yummy. Oh, okay. Are my children yummy? What else?
Restaurant.
Okay. Morals. Goldman Sachs.
Crooks.
Rolex. Yeah. So let me tell you what I put down. So for Abraham Lincoln, I put honesty. Right? Did we come close to that? Yeah. Okay. Honest Abe. Benedict Arnold, traitor. That was easy, wasn't it? A Yugo, literally, piece of junk. That's what I wrote down. It's a car, made in Yugoslavia. Thus the name Yugo. Chick-fil-A, put great customer service. Goldman Sachs, greed. And Rolex, quality. Why do these people, these products, these businesses, why do we associate them with those words? It's because it's their reputation. In 1990, if I would have said Goldman Sachs, would you have said greed? Would you have said crooks? Maybe, but probably not. But that's where they are now. So what is your reputation? So what if I didn't just stop at Rolex and I started naming names of people in the building? When your name is mentioned, what do people think of? How will people remember you when you're dead? Are they going to remember you like Fred Rogers or Joe Delaney, a person who's known for doing good and being good? Are you going to be like O.J. Simpson or Jared Fogle from Subway? You're going to be known as a person for evil. In many ways, your reputation is an awful lot like how you smell. You ever thought about that? Your reputation is kind of how you smell. Everybody notices it when you arrive, and it lingers long after you leave. You ever been around somebody who doesn't smell very well? Like, really doesn't smell very well. I had this experience this week at work. I was walking past our front desk, and I walked into a cloud of someone's reputation. Do you know what happened for the next hour? I felt like it was on me. Right? The stink was on me. A couple of weeks ago, I killed a deer, and I gutted the deer. And if you've ever had blood on your hands, you know this experience. You go and wash your hands, and you're like, man, it's still on me. And you wash your hands again, and you're like, it's still on me. Our reputation is like that. And a bad reputation is like that, too. When you enter a room, people notice. And long after you're gone, people still know that. A good reputation has quite the opposite effect, too. In Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 1, this is what we're told about a good reputation. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. You see, a good reputation is like perfume. It's like cologne. I work in a perfume, lotion, cologne-free environment. It just doesn't work for the folks that we need to take care of. And I always notice when somebody is wearing cologne and perfume. And I, in particular, notice when Emily wears perfume. That smells good. I bet you notice, too, when your spouse wears cologne or perfume. It's refreshing. It gives you good thoughts, good memories, as opposed to the foul stench of a bad reputation. Your legacy is that reputation that you have once you're dead. You know, some people try to change their legacy by writing things on their tombstone. But in the truth, we know what a reputation after you're dead is. We know what your legacy is because your deeds, what you've done, will testify about you even after you're gone. In Hebrews chapter 11, verse 4, talking about those people of faith that are mentioned in the Old Testament, this is what the Bible says about Abel. By faith, Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts, and through it, he, being dead, still speaks. Think about that. Abel has been dead since before anyone else was dead. Abel was the first person to die. And through Abel's good works, his reputation, he still speaks to us. So how do you build a good reputation? How do you make your reputation smell like perfume? Well, if a good reputation is like perfume and more desirable than great riches, how can I ensure that I have a good reputation? Well, unfortunately, there's no magic bullet, no step-by-step checklist, but there are a few things that we can do to help to have a good reputation. I think it boils down to three things. The first is keep your word. The second is keep your standards. And the third is do good. So let's talk about those. Keep your word, keep your standards, and do good. First of all, keep your word. Sadly, this is becoming more and more uncommon, isn't it? People no longer feel an obligation to keep their promises. Not in business, not in marriage, not in any part of life. You know, it's kind of interesting. I don't want to make this sermon political, but it's very interesting. Our current president made a promise, a campaign promise, that he was going to move the embassy in Israel from where it is now, which I think is Tel Aviv, into Jerusalem. And now everybody's all up in arms because he's actually fulfilling a campaign promise. We're actually shocked that a person would fulfill their promise. Now, it may have something to do with the occupation of being a politician, that we just get conditioned that politicians make promises and don't keep them. But that's the culture that we live in. We live in a society now where people just don't keep their word. It used to be that your word was your bond. That if you and I were going to agree to something, we would shake hands and it was over. That was, the deal was done. We might not even need to shake hands. We might just say, I'm going to do this for you and you're going to pay me this amount, or I'm going to trade you this for that, and it was over. Now we have contracts. And you know what the most important thing of a contract is? What do you do when things don't go well? How do you get out of the contract? That's the most important piece of a contract. We spend hours and hours trying to find ways to get out of keeping our word. At least in the world, that seems to be the society we live in. But in Matthew chapter 5, verse 7 or 37, this is what we're told. But let your yes be yes and your no, no. For whatever is more than these is from the evil one. Keep your word. When you say you're going to do something, do it. If you say you're not going to do something, don't do it. If you're going to be a certain place, say you're going to be there, be there. In Psalm chapter 15, or in Psalm 15, David poses a question at the beginning of the psalm, who may abide in thy tent? Meaning, who is worthy to stand before God? And it answers by stating many qualities that we all should have. We're actually going to look at Psalm 15, so if you want to turn to it, that'd be good. But I want to point out one that's mentioned there in verse 4. So David asks this question, who can abide in thy tent? And he answers the question through the psalm. But in verse 4, he mentions that one quality that a person is to have is that he swears to his own hurt, but does not change. In other words, a person gives their word, and things change, and it puts him at the short end, the losing end. This isn't going to turn out well for him. But he doesn't change. He doesn't go back on his word because he gave his word. His word is more important than his advantage. And that's how we should be. When we give our word should be gold. Psalm 15. Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell in your holy hill? And verse 2 through verse 5. These are great things. Probably all of these are things that we ought to be doing to have a good reputation. He who walks uprightly and works righteousness and speaks the truth in his heart. He who does not backbite with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor does he take up a reproach against his friend. In whose eyes a vile person is despised, but he honors those who fear the Lord. He who swears to his own hurt and does not change. He who does not put out his money for usury, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things shall never be moved. If you want to know how to get a good reputation, just follow Psalm 15. I could probably sit down, but I do have some more things to talk about. So keep your word. Second thing is keep your standards. This, of course, requires that you first have standards. You ever heard somebody, they don't have any standards. Right, does that person have a good reputation? Usually not. So have standards. So there are many standards that we could choose from. But I encourage you to choose God's standards rather than man's standards. In Romans chapter 12, verse 1, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your body a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. You see, verse 2 sort of puts it into perspective for us. There's kind of two standards in the world, aren't there? I mean, there's lots of standards, but they really boil down to God's standards and everything else. Don't be conformed to the everything else. Instead, be transformed to God's standards. So know the standard and adhere to it. Don't ever waver and don't ever change. This is about being faithful. Be faithful to the Word of God. Not everybody is going to agree with your standards, but everyone can value an individual who consistently adheres to a standard. You ever notice that? You might not agree with a person, but if they are consistent, you can respect them, can't you? They might be wrong, but you can respect them because they're consistent. A person who just is wishy-washy with their standards, what kind of reputation does that person have? So, keep your word, keep your standard, and do good. Remember that a reputation is what others think of you. Right? We could talk about building character because your character is what eventually develops into other people's opinion of you. And sometimes people might have a bad opinion of you and it not be based in your character. We could have read some passages in the Bible that talk about that, that there's going to be people who try to slander you because you're a Christian. But in the end, the thing that you can control is you can do good. If those around you never see you do good things, what kind of opinion are they going to have of you? Probably neutral at best. In Matthew chapter 5, verses 14 through 16, Jesus says this, "You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." Do good things. Be that light that's set on a hill. And we have to balance this with other things that are mentioned. Jesus, just a little bit later in Matthew chapter 6, verses 1 through 4, talks about flaunting our good deeds. He does it in terms of our charitable deeds, but let's read that as well. "Take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, do not sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. But when you do a charitable deed, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that your charitable deed may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you openly." These two passages seem, at least on the surface, to be telling us to do different things, don't they? One passage says, be a light. Do your good works so that everyone can see them. The other says, do your good works in secret. What's really the message here? Well, the message is about the purpose by which you are doing those good works. In Matthew chapter 5, it says in verse 16, "Let your light so shine before men." But why? Why are you doing your good works so that others can see them? "That they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." In Matthew chapter 6, verse 1, we're cautioned, "Take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men." Why? To be seen by them. It goes on to talk about if that's why you're doing that, if you're flaunting it so that you can get a physical reward so people can praise you, well, then you've got the reward that you're going to get. Do good deeds, but do them for the right reason. And do them with the idea so that people can see through you the reputation of God. We're supposed to be Christ-like, aren't we? Christ is the sun, and in some ways we're the moon, aren't we? The sun S-O-N, but also S-U-N, in that Christ is the light and we're reflective of the light, aren't we? And so people, when they see us, they should see our good works and it be a reputation on us, but really a reflection of Jesus. The good deeds we should do should be done for God's glory. In turn, we ought to use our good reputation for the benefit of God's kingdom. So why is it important that we have a good reputation? Well, a good reputation leads to positive influence. Just having a good reputation, if you don't do anything with it, is really, I don't know that it's, if it's any benefit at all. We all have influence on people around us. And if you don't believe me, think about this for a minute. Consider the language that your coworkers use when you are around them. I had this very interesting experience that keeps repeating itself over and over again. I don't use profanity, but I don't flaunt the fact that I don't use profanity. People notice. And on more than one occasion, there have been people that I work with, my boss, sometimes co-workers, sometimes my employees, will use profanity around me and immediately apologize for doing it. Now, they don't do that when they're talking with other people. Well, why do they do that? Because my life, my lack of that profanity, has an influence on them. And that's just one example of many. We all have an influence, whether good or bad, on those people who are around us. In Proverbs chapter 27, verse 17, we're told, as iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friends. We influence the people who we associate with. And we are expected to influence the world in a very positive way. In Matthew chapter 5, verse 13, so we just talked about us being the light of the world. Well, what preceded that? Matthew 5, 13, you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. We are supposed to have a good reputation so that we can have a positive influence. I mean, what do you do when your food doesn't taste very good? Sometimes you put a little salt on it to influence the taste. Don't put too much on it, but you put some on it, and it has a positive influence on the taste of the food, and it helps it to taste better. And so likewise, we are the same. We are the salt of the earth. We are there to season, to have a positive influence on the world. But what good are we if our reputation is ruined? Well, Luke records Jesus teaching these same things. I like how Luke says it in Luke 14, verse 34. Salt is good, but if the salt has lost its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is neither fit for the land nor for the dunghill, but men throw it out. He who has an ear, let him hear. If we have lost our influence, what good are we? We're good for nothing. Good to be thrown out. Know this, Christians are under the world's microscope. The world wants to see us fail. And why is that? Because it allows them to justify their sins. Consider David and Bathsheba. Notice what David says to Bathsheba in 2 Samuel chapter 12. Remember, Nathan comes to David and says, gives him this story about a man who has stolen another man's lamb. And David says, this man's going to die. And then Nathan says, you're the one. Let's pick up the story in verse 13. So David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said to David, the Lord has also put away your sin. You shall not die. However, because you did this deed, you have given great occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme. The child also who is born to you shall surely die. Look at what Nathan says to David. Nathan says, God has forgiven your sin. However, there were consequences. One consequence was the child was going to die. But before he mentions that, what does he say? David, you've given opportunity for the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme. When we falter, when we do wrong things, we give the enemies of the Lord the opportunity to blaspheme. Others had committed adultery in Israel, most certainly. And their adultery had gone unnoticed by the enemies of God. But this was David. It's inevitable that the sin of this one man of influence and reputation would result in greater scandal than the sins of the multitudes of people with lesser influence and lesser reputation who had committed the same thing. We are a light on the hill. People look to us. And as a result, when we falter, we lose our influence. So, how do you ruin your reputation? Well, it's sort of the exact opposite of how you gain a reputation. First of all, do dumb things, right? You want to ruin your reputation. It's actually a whole lot easier than building a good reputation. Just do some dumb things. Let me give you an example. All of you know, I bet you know this man's name. His name is Ryan Lochte. He is the second most decorated Olympic swimmer in the history of the Olympics, right? If it weren't for the other guy, oh no, I'm drawing a blank now, Michael Phelps. If it wasn't for Michael Phelps, we'd all be talking about Ryan Lochte because he's a great swimmer. His net worth, just because he's a great swimmer, is something like $6 million. I don't know how that works, but that's how it works. But what do we know of him? Well, at the 2016 Olympics in Rio, he made up this ridiculous story about how he and three of his fellow swimmers were robbed at gunpoint. It was a lie. It was a fabrication. He was just stupid drunk. And what happened? He had this great reputation. His reputation is what led him to have a net worth of $6 million. Because swimming in the Olympics, you don't get any money for doing that. He makes money based on his reputation. He makes money through sponsorships, through celebrity appearances. And all of that was lost. This one dumb thing he did, he lost sponsorships. He lost $5 to $10 million in income. And apparently celebrities have this thing called a favorability rating. I wanted to know if I had one and couldn't find one, so I'm apparently either not favorable or highly favorable. But in the span of the three-day period that all of this was coming out, his favorability rating went from 90% positive to 70% negative. He lost it all. He did something dumb. So you want to ruin your reputation, do dumb things. That's the first thing. The second thing is be unreliable. If you want to ruin your reputation, just fail to be dependable. Don't always do what you're asked to do or expected to do. Don't be responsible. Don't take on duties. Don't ever go above and beyond what you're expected. Don't be trustworthy. Just because you say you're going to do something doesn't mean that you're going to follow through with it. Get sidetracked easily. Say, oh, I forgot. I mean, think about it. Would you hire a person who does that? Would you marry a person who is that way? Can you trust them? Can you expect them to give you help? Can you depend on them? And yet, people get this reputation. One of the pharaohs in Egypt had this reputation. In 2 Kings chapter 18, Hezekiah was having some problems. And let's just pick up in verse 19. Then the Rabshakeh said to them, "Say now to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this in which you trust? You speak of having plans and power for war, but they are mere words. And in whom do you trust that you rebel against me? Now look, you are trusting in the staff of this broken reed, Egypt, on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and all who trust in him." This Pharaoh, and I didn't have time to look up who he was, he had this reputation of being terribly unreliable. And this officer, the Rabshakeh, he was reminding Hezekiah, "So you're going to resist against the king of Assyria and you're going to rely on the king in Egypt? Well, just remember that he's not a reliable person." So do dumb things, don't be reliable, and be inconsistent. Say one thing and do another. Proverbs chapter 26, verse 7, and it took me a long time of thinking about this proverb for it to make sense. Like the legs of the lame that hang limp is a proverb in the mouth of fools. Like the legs of the lame that hang limp is the proverb in the mouth of fools. If you have a limp leg that you can't do anything with, what good is it? Just kind of in your way. So too are proverbs, wise sayings in the mouth of fools. You ever been around somebody who is just not very smart? And then when they start telling you, giving you advice, what do you, you're like, what on earth? Be inconsistent. Romans chapter 2, verse 21 through 24. You therefore who teach another, do you not teach yourself? You who preach that a man should not steal, do you steal? You who say, do not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who make your boast in the law, do you dishonor God through breaking the law? For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you, as it is written. Remember how in Ecclesiastes 7 and 1, Solomon compares a good reputation to perfume? Well, consider what else Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 10 and 1. Dead flies putrefy the perfumer's ointment and cause it to give off a foul odor. So does a little folly to one respected for wisdom and honor. So, you want to lose your good reputation? It's really easy to do. It's really easy to do. That's the lesson I have for you this morning about our reputation and our influence. Reputation is about the opinion that others have of you. What's your reputation with God? It's a little different in that situation. God doesn't have an opinion about us. God knows about us. It's not our reputation, it's the real thing. What does God think of you? When you think of that, and if you find that God would not look favorably on you, you have an opportunity now, as you do any time, to make correction. Whether it's through primary obedience, or whether you found yourself that you've made some bad choices in life and fallen short of God's expectations, you have an opportunity to make that right now, as you do at any time, but make it known as we stand and sing.